linguistic logic.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. So, do I see some dust on your clothes? Did you just get back from Burning Man? Actually, I know the answer to that question because the temple just burned last night, which means that if you are already back from the burn, it's very doubtful that you've gotten your life back together enough to listen to a podcast. I think it took me at least a month or so to get back into the groove last year. So I guess it's just those of us who weren't able to make it to the burn this year who are here now. But I'm sure that our Burning Man contingent will be reporting in before too much longer to let us know how they fared with the big dust storms that I saw in John Graham's video feed. Hopefully everyone made it through without any problems of any real magnitude. But there are no problems here in the salon today because we've had our expenses taken care of by Glenn P., Garrett W., and Samuel H., all of whom very kindly sent us some of their hard-earned cash to help offset our expenses. And by the way, I should mention that after having come up too short on cash to make it to Burning Man this year, I've decided to set aside a little bit from the donations each month and put it in my Send an Old Guy to Camp Fund, which is my goofy way of saying that I'm planning on bringing Palenque Norte back to the playa next year. So thanks again, Glenn, Garrett, and Samuel, and I hope to see you all on the playa next year yourself, and thank you in person. Now, for today's lecture, it took me a little while to get into the flow of the talk I'm about to play for you, because at first I couldn't understand why Timothy Leary thought that the 60s were such a great success. As I understand it now, what he seems to be pointing out is that the big success of the 60s was that it was a period when change in all capital letters, finally began to become the dominant paradigm, and that the status quo had finally been forced to be on the move again. Now, the notes that accompanied this tape said it was recorded in Big Sur, California in 1990. But in it, he talks about Jimmy Carter being president, and at another point, he says that he thinks the 80s hold great promise. little did he know that the 80s would bring us Reagan and Bush the first, huh? He also mentions being recently released from prison, all of which leads me to believe that perhaps this talk was recorded in 1979 and not 1990, but you'll have to decide that for yourself. I'll have more to say about Dr. Leary's take on things after you've had a chance to hear what he was thinking back then, whenever it was, but I'll warn you ahead of time. Unless you live in California, he's probably going to make you mad at one point in this talk. And now that you've been warned, well, just sit back and enjoy listening to another very entertaining and informative lecture by Dr. Timothy Leary.
Thank you. I'm happy to be free to be here tonight. I had a slight delay in getting here, like a detour of 8 years. During the last 8 years of the Nixon administration, they kind of made it illegal for people to go around expressing new ideas. I'm glad to say that the prohibition on new ideas has been repealed. I've been traveling around the country for the last few months, kind of checking out what's happening. And I have a couple of announcements I'd like to share with you about my observations. The first one is that there is, at the present time in this country, an epidemic of good feeling. It is legal to smile once again. During the last 8 years, it was a heavy period. It was a down period. The people that really understood what was happening didn't feel like smiling. We were almost like Eskimos. You had to barricade yourself against the vibrations that were coming down. However, this has changed. There's a feeling in the country now that is similar in many ways to the early 60s when people can look each other in the eye. There's a sense of hope and expectation for change. Now, another announcement I have to make is this. This country is now being run by successful and intelligent heads from the 60s. By that I mean the intelligent and articulate young women and men who 10, 12 years ago were forced into positions of dissent and protest and drop out, have dropped back in, and are now taking over positions of responsibility for what's going on. This change in who's running the country is no surprise. We knew it was going to happen. You see, what's happening is that we simply had to wait until the generation of the 60s moved into to a situation of maturity. We've got to get used to this idea, you see, that we won the great contest of the 60s. Like it or not, or ready or not, we have become the establishment. Now, again, during those 8 years, we were forced to feel that we were alienated or that we were a counterculture. There's no question of that anymore. We've got to accept the responsibility of freedom and accept the necessity to stand up proud and tall and start creating the external realities which our internal visions led us to believe were possible. Now, this is no surprise. We knew this was going to happen. I remember back in the early 60s reading a Gallup poll which said that 75% of the students at the Harvard Law School were smoking grass. So I said to my friends, our legal troubles will be over in 10 years. And there was another finding that is even more important than this. At the same time, say 1968 or 69, 65% of the young women and men in the science and engineering schools, MIT, Caltech, RPI, Georgia Tech, we're also smoking grass, which means that now we have in this country, for the first time, perhaps in centuries, a new generation of women and men who have experienced in their own nervous systems the energies, biological and genetic and physical, about which they write equations and which they study with their complex instruments. And it's these young scientists who are also humanists who are going to produce a technological society in which the technology is run by deeply artistic human people. I was saying a few months ago, our task is this. We have to eroticize the scientists and scientize the eroticists. Now, I'm sure that many of you have been confused over the last few years about what people call my image. Now, as you well know, I never wanted any credibility. I'm more concerned with incredibility. But I'll speak a few words about this business of image, which is all media hype and partisan image making, as you well know. Sometimes I think there's hardly one immorality or sin of both the left wing and the right wing that hasn't been attributed to me at one point or another. In the early days, early 60s at Harvard University, we were performing some biochemical experiments in the laboratory. There was a slight accident, and I was cloned. There are 24 Timothy Larrys running around the world. We learned in the 60s that your head is your own, your brain creates your own reality, so pick out the one you want. There are Timothy Larrys that will make you feel good or feel bad. As it happens, the one that I'm hooked up with is performing a very simple function. I believe in change. I'm a change agent. I want to keep changing myself. Now, I'm very selfish about this. I want to grow. I want to develop. And I'm learning step by step through many, many years of diligent study and experimentation how to facilitate the process of continual change. Now, you know, in the past, before electromagnetic communication, television, radio, changes took place very slowly and painfully in the human situation. It would take maybe once a century, once every 300 years, a group of women or men would have an idea, would have a vision, a revelation, perhaps because of some vegetables they ate or something, who knows. It would take literally centuries before a real change idea would travel from the Middle East to Athens, Greece, or something like that. And the changes until very recently were very Newtonian. You were changing from A to B. You were changing from Catholicism to Protestantism, or from capitalism to Marxism. It was always linear. It was always either or. With the advent of Einsteinian thinking, with the new quantum mechanics, with the new mathematics, with the new existential Einsteinian neurology and psychopharmacology, we are now into a period when change is the name of the game. I'm not talking about future shock, because Toffler's book was mainly present shock. I'm talking about the fact that change is going to be the norm from now on. And we're not changing from A to B, we're changing in an explosive, multi-directional way. Now, by the way, my lecture tonight comes in cycles, as everything in life does. It's carefully orchestrated in mathematical sequences, but I'm sure that at one point or another, you may get lost, because I'm going to try to give you more survival information, more scholarly scientific information. I'm going to try to jam you with enough neurological signals that perhaps you've never experienced before, because I think we're ready. We've come out of the cocoon and the sloth of the late 60s and 70s, and I think you're ready to receive a lot of information. If you lose me now and then, don't worry. I'm going to orbit back behind you, and I'll pick you up. I've been orbiting back around you for many decades, you remember. Okay, I'm going to be talking about change. There are forces in society which are designed to scare you about change, to put brakes on change. Now, certainly, in 1977, at this elevated level of evolution, we have grown beyond good guy, bad guy scenarios. So when I say that there are forces in society, and there are forces in every species which slow down change, there's no sense of complaint. I mean, how can we complain tonight at this moment of triumph and celebration as a people and as a culture? Yeah, there are forces which slow down change. Certainly, you're aware of the fact that every educational institution from first grade up to the high altitude of the College of Marin, every institution that's supported by taxpayers and administered by politicians is carefully designed to keep young people serenely and productively stupid. Now, again, this is not a complaint. It's supposed to be that way. A species, a culture, a people has to have those that keep the central tendency going. You have to have a centripetal tendency. They have to warn you, don't get too far out or you get picked off, so forth. It's necessary to have the conservatives, but it's also necessary to have the mutants, the migrants, the people with new ideas. And I want to remind you, do not be afraid of change. We're now entering into a cultural period in which it's delta change. It's the change of the changes. And I want to remind each of you in this room that you've been through at least four tremendously shattering and dramatic mutations and migrations in just the short number of years that you've been on this planet. Because these are the three M's of evolution, both for a species and for an individual. Mutation, metamorphosis, and migration. Mutation is the way the DNA code improves a species. It's diversity. DNA code is continually mutating towards greater complexity. And metamorphosis is the way individuals can change. But migration is always the key, the tool, for getting smarter and trying out new things. And sitting here in a room of Californians closest to the Pacific Ocean, we certainly are dealing with an audience of both mutants and migrants. Now, I told you that each one of you in this room has gone through four very dramatic mutations and migrations. You remember at one time, each of us was a tiny little creature in our mother's arms. We were very much like amoebas in the sense that we couldn't walk, we couldn't even lift our heads around. We had these enormous big heads and shrunken bodies, and a single circuit to our nervous system which allowed us to turn towards, like an amoeba, towards food and warmth and away from harmful stimuli. Then there came that first dramatic mutation in migration when, like it or not, ready or not, our bodies began to elongate in relationship to our head, and we began getting restless feelings. We were getting too big for our mother's arms, and we migrated. We took that first great leap down to the floor. Now, this is a very risky thing to do because it was so nice and cozy in the affluence of our mother's arms. And it was a nice, laid-back, sensual place to be. But we did take that great leap. We got down the floor, which was pretty risky. We had to avoid getting put down or stepped on. We had to learn the mammalian game of pecking order and status and bluff and camouflage. We developed a second circuit of our nervous system, which taught us the emotional game. We became mammals, in other words. But again, the migration and mutation continued. At a certain period, a few years later, the left circuit, the left hemisphere of our brains kicked into operation. We developed facility with the thumb and forefinger. We learned how to rub the nine muscles of our vocal cords together. In other words, we became symbol-dealing primates, little monkeys. And with this migration, with this mutation, we migrated away from home and the schoolyard down to the primary school, to the secondary school, to the high school, where there occurred the fourth great dramatic mutation. And it wasn't because we were good little monkeys getting good grades in school. It was genetically predetermined that at a certain point in our early teens, dramatic physiological changes took place in our bodies. And we developed protuberances and hair growths in the most surprising places. And all sorts of light bulbs went out in our brains, and we got that fourth circuit of our nervous system, which taught us a new reality, which was both attractive and quite appealing and certainly very shattering. In a word, we learned the great sperm-egg exchange game. We learned how to become sexual impersonators. We learned how to become domesticated primates, where we attend institutions of this sort and assemble in these primate packs to decide when and where we go next. Now, this sequence of mutation and migration, which we have encountered individually, of course, simply recapitulates the history of life on this planet. The historians and the geneticists tell us that at one time, all life on this planet was underwater. All life was amoeboid, like amoebas. And then there came that first youth rebellion, when some of the restless migrant amoeba began straying off to shallow pools and began experimenting with dangerous drugs like calcium. Now, you remember there was that great, great flack when the AMA, that's the Amoeba Medical Association, announced that calcium was an extremely dangerous drug. It broke chromosomes and caused mutations. Why, these young people ingest calcium and they develop heads. They begin thrashing around aimlessly instead of floating peaceably like nice undergraduate amoeba. Some of them swim away, never to be seen by their parents again. And I'm sure the amoeba theologian said if God had intended amoebas to grow bones, she would not have made calcium illegal. But evolution keeps moving us upward and outward. There was that great mutation of migration when some fathers climbed up on the shoreline and began laying around on the shoreline, digging on that strange new electromagnetic phenomena, sunlight, and sniffing dangerous chemicals like oxygen. And I'm sure, again, the marine life law establishment said, you know, this oxygen is not only lethal, but it's expensive. Takes one tree to get a gram. But mutations continue. We climbed up on the shoreline. We climbed up on 4 feet. We moved out to the forest. We became mammals. We developed again as a species the great mammalian emotional game of territory, property, pecking order, dominance. But then some of our foremothers and forefathers stood up on 2 feet and moved us higher and faster. Now, I'm sure that the mammalian law enforcement establishment said, hey, we're getting reports that some of these mammals are developing the opposable forefinger and thumb, and they're making tools. Well, pass a law against tool making, but Bring some of those tools down to headquarters. Confiscate them. Maybe we can use them. Evolution continued as a species, mutation, migration. One of the great breakthroughs in evolution, I'm sure, was that time when one young experimental couple mutated and migrated off somewhere, and in spite of the technological problems involved, they started making love face to face. Now, this really blew the establishment because, I'm sure when the establishment learned that people were getting civilized and making love face to face, is that that's impossible. It's technologically impossible. Chief, they're doing it. And they're looking in each other's eyes. We're going to lose control if they start doing that. We became good sexual impersonators, civilized, domesticated primates as a species. And then I want to point out to you again that this same rule of mutation and migration holds true. Isn't it true that human intelligence and human civilization has migrated systematically from east to west? We're told that civilization started in the Middle East or the East, perhaps China, and it has moved consistently westward. We had the great civilizations of Egypt, the pyramids. Inside the pyramids, there are all the equipment for some sort of time travel experiments or post-terrestrial experiments. At the same time, or shortly thereafter, the Babylonians began developing astronomy, medicine, the rudiments of social life, and they began singing the great epic song of Gilgamesh, the first great tripper who voyaged out, the first great migrant who voyaged out beyond the charts and the guideposts, seeking the key of immortality, seeking... Perhaps he didn't know what he was seeking, because the migrants often don't know what they're seeking, except some inchoate and unconscious vision, a restless imperative that they have to keep moving outward and onward. Civilization then moved to Greece. We recall it was exactly at the time when the Greeks developed facility with bronze and metal tools and built those first ships, the prows of which clove the wine dark sea of the Mediterranean, exactly at that time when the Greeks were moving outward. Because it's a time when a country or a culture has enough confidence and enough courage and enough vision and intelligence to move outward, it's exactly at those times that the great high points of that civilization occur. Because when the Greeks were migrating, it was Sophocles and Aeschylus writing those great plays. Socrates and Plato and Aristotle were developing Western philosophy. And the great mathematical and physical philosophers were speculating about the nature of energy. And the great architects and sculptors of Greece were raising that culture to its highest point. But then the Greeks stopped migrating. They settled back in affluence, and the Romans took over. Virgil's great song. Isn't it true that all the great epic poems of each country and each people are trip stories about women and men who had the courage, or at least were pushed by some genetic imperative, to move beyond the limits, to probe the mysteries of the far-out regions for their people, for their species, and for their culture. Then the Arabs burst out of the North African, across North Africa, up into the great high-water marks of their civilization, the universities of Cordoba and Sevilla. It was exactly at the moment when the Arabs were migrating that the great Arab mathematics, the great Sufi poetry, the great Arab medicine and philosophy was developing. Then a very interesting thing happened when this relentless migration of the most intelligent, because it's always the intelligent that move. It's always the intelligent that migrate, because it's simply smarter to move out than to stay back in the village and quarrel over cobblestone streets and neighborhood territory. Because quarreling over territory is lower mammalian and lower primate. And it's the smart, the evolutionary people that always move out. Now, that interesting thing happened in the Middle Ages when this relentless movement of intelligent people westward came to the North Atlantic. And you know what happened? Again, the conservative forces said, you can't migrate anymore. That's what the Dark Ages were all about. You can't move out because the North Atlantic, number one, you'll fall off the edge. Number two, you'll get eaten by dragons. Number three, you'll get busted by narcotics agents. Or whatever other fear-inducing stimulus kept people close at home and tried to rob them of their courage and their confidence to move outward. Well, you know what happened. Prince Henry the Navigator sent his voyagers out around the Cape, and Queen Isabella pawned her jewels to finance the Nassau voyages of Christopher Columbus, and Queen Elizabeth got Parliament to fund the astronaut voyages of Sir Francis Drake. And isn't it true? It was exactly at the moment when the great European countries were migrating and moving outward that the high moments of their literature and poetry and architecture occurred. Now, you know what happened. Finally, the intelligent people, the visionaries, the restless people, moved from the old world to the new world. Now, let me take a moment to contrast the old world and the new world for you. I have spent one-third of my adult life in the old world, sometimes voluntarily and sometimes on the run. Now, I love the old world because the old world is a museum. And talk about quaintness, my friends. I mean, I've overdosed on quaintness. I love the history. I love the tradition. I love the charm. I love that family structure that's so important to the Europeans and the sense of authority and tradition. I love the care they give to material objects and how they hold on to these objects century after century. It's wonderful. But I want to tell you, my friends, nothing is happening in Europe. Because in the old world, every smart African, every smart Asian, every smart European has gotten themselves over here because it's this new continent and this new land that has the room, both geographically and psychologically, to move out with new ideas and new visions of how we can live as individuals and as groups together. Now, the same process occurred in this country. First, there was that band of 13 colonies along the East Coast. You see, you have to become smarter when you migrate. I'm sure that the old world people said it's very risky to go over to the new world. Why, there are no cobblestone streets, and there are no dukes and counts to tell you what to do, or no bishops, and there are no... Yeah, they said, exactly. So these visionaries, these kooks, sat down and wrote documents like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and we developed the technology, because this technology would never have moved as the way it did in the United States. We built the railroads, we built the steamboats, we built the teletypes and the telephones. Why? Because where there's room to move out, you get smarter to bridge the distance and to develop the technology to live. Now, we've been told that there have been three great consciousness movements or mutations in the short history of this country. The first one occurred in 1740, Jonathan Edwards, and that led directly to the dropping out from the British Empire and King George and the Church of England. Then in 1840, 1850, there was a second great consciousness movement, that hippy-dippy thing that occurred in New York State and Pennsylvania, when all of a sudden things got a little cramped in the Eastern Seaboard, and people began having strange visions and dressing in new clothes and speaking in new tongues and having new ideas about how life could be lived. And naturally, they got in trouble with City Hall. So they sold their land, they pawned their possessions, and they bought those extremely risky spaceships called covered wagons, and they headed west. I'm talking about the Amish, the Shakers, the Quakers, the Mormons. There were literally hundreds of groups that got new ideas about how women and men could live together in tune and harmony with a better vision, and they moved out as the smart ones always do. Now, an interesting thing happened about 50 years ago. The movement of intelligence westward for 5,000 years hit the Pacific coast of California, and for the first time in 5,000 years, there was no place left to go. And I attribute some of the malaise and the confusion in this country in the last few decades to this fact, that for the first time in the history of our species, there's no more room left for the courageous, for the intelligent, for the restless, and for the genetically predisposed to move out into new places where there's room for new visions and new ways of living. Now, let's review. Oh, by the way, I made a terrible mistake in this lecture. I should have told you earlier, and I hope you'll forgive me. I have an important message for you. I beg you, do not believe anything I say. My understanding of the nervous system is this. I've been studying the brain for about 25 years. Pedestrian work in the laboratory. Staggering, plotting, disciplined, step by step into the future. And my understanding of the brain is this, 111 billion cell computer capable of having millions of ideas a second. The brain, my friends, the mind is not a set of ice tongs that you grab onto an idea and hold it. Pick up an idea, put it down, pick it up, try it out. Get 10 ideas a day. Come on, your brain can handle 10 ideas a minute, 10 ideas a second. So I'm simply rubbing my vocal cords together, sending signals to you that possibly will stimulate your brains to new ideas, new visions, and possibly new migrations. Now, we've been doing, we've been spinning time loops here. I reviewed our brief history as primates on this planet. I reviewed the histories of our species. I reviewed the 5,000-year march of intelligence westward. And by the way, since this is a political Northern California audience, let me just remind you of the political implications of this movement of intelligence westward. They say that you go back east, and you better believe that's true. Because when you go back east, you're going back in time and down in intelligence. Californians are smarter than the people in the Midwest. You know, I was in Buffalo about 2 weeks ago, and the snowdrifts were 20 feet tall, and they couldn't move. And I said to my friends in Buffalo, is an intelligence test that you have flunked. You know, the weatherman in Buffalo quit. Finally, after 10 years, said, what am I doing here? Get me a ticket to San Diego or to Los Angeles or San Francisco. The same thing is true when you go back to New England. Now, I'm from New England. I love New England, but New England is a museum. I mean, it really is. They're living in this quaint little Freudian world in New England. You know. Now, when you go to the old world, what's happening in London? You're going back 100 years when you go to London. When you go to Paris, 150 years. Paris is ahead of Rome. Rome's ahead of Athens. Athens is ahead of Istanbul. I mean, isn't it clear? The old world must be considered with compassion. With ecological compassion. I mean, we got to preserve these ancient species. Okay. Uganda. Is there any intelligent person left in Uganda? I mean, I'll give you Pakistan. Pakistan is fighting on the right hand India. They're fighting on the left hand Afghanistan. China's fighting Russia. China's fighting India. I'll cite you. Listen, I'm not being chauvinistic here because the smart Europeans and the smart Africans and the smart Asians are in this country and in this state. I happen to be 1,000% Irish. I look at my Irish forebears that stayed there. Do you know what's happening in Belfast? Catholics are killing Protestants. I mean, that's 400 years out of date. You know, the Protestant parents are teaching their children to hate Catholics. We must treat the old world with a... send them veterinary medicine. Send them food. We should absolutely not interfere with their politics. I mean, come on. We sent, who is it, Avril Harriman, speaking of dinosaurs. Carter sends Harriman over to Cyprus to try to stop the Turks from fighting the Greeks. And as a little AP wire says, of course, the Greeks and the Turks have been fighting each other for 4,000 or 5,000 years. I mean, let's send Avril Harriman out to the prairies to stop the lions fighting the tigers, huh? Or now Carter wants to start a buffer state in the Middle East. Well, you know, a buffer state in the Middle East, come on. But we must send to our friends in the old world the signal that it's smart to move west. By all means, let the smart ones in. It's an intelligence test. I want to call your attention to the fact that the eastern countries have to put up walls to prevent their smartest people from leaving. You know? There's a Chinese wall, and there's the Berlin Wall, and their exit visas yet, and they all know, all those eastern countries know that the smart ones want out. Yeah. I never saw a wall built keeping people from going west to east. Did you? Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not about to form a trio to sing God Bless America with Eldridge Cleaver and Patty Hearst. However, I do think it's time to realize who we Americans are. Everyone in this room is the seed descendant of some kooky, far-out mothers and fathers who had it with the old world and wanted room to move. And I don't care what they can. Okay, let's spin the time dial again. I want to call your attention to the last 32 years from the year 1945, because that's the title of my lecture or whatever you call this rumination tonight. 1945 to 1985. I want to submit to you that the years since 1945 have been the most volatile breakthrough three decades in human history. I use the term, brawling species of domesticated primates finally got the technological know-how to fission the atom, release the basic energy of the universe. And at that point, it was very clear, I'm sure, that the DNA code of every living species since the radiation, since the fallout of Alamogordo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the subsequent tests, and said, hey, they've done it. It's time to get off this planet because nuclear energy does not belong on a tiny planet like ours. In addition to the fission and fusion of the atom in the last 32 years, we had, of course, that tremendous breakthrough in which Watson, Crick, and an unknown woman, who didn't get the Nobel Prize, although she did the X-ray work that set the thing up. In any case, geneticists finally decoded the DNA code, unveiled the literal secret of life, and brings us to this moment when we can unblinkingly consider the possibility of genetic engineering and immortality. But again, genetic engineering is too volatile and too complicated to be experimented with on a small planet like this. Sure, clearly, we've got many planets and many laboratories up there where nuclear fusion, nuclear propulsion, and genetic engineering can take place. The most important thing that's happened, though, in the last 32 years is the mass popularization of electromagnetic communication. I like to think, I find it amusing and stimulating my intelligence to think that everyone born after the year 1945 is a mutant. You literally belong to a new species. You belong to the neuroelectric species, the neurotelepathic species. The point is this, that everyone born after 1945, when you first crawled out of the crib or the cradle and toddled over to the boob tube, and with your tiny, chubby, baby little hands, you began to dial and tune reality. Yeah. Post Toasties, Wheaties, Rice Krispies, hype, con, salesmanship, turn it off, Ford, no, Chevrolet, no, Ford, Carter, Disneyland. The average child in the 50s, the average television child in the 50s, experienced more spectrum of reality in 1 week than the most affluent, aristocratic, and well-traveled people of the centuries before. Because these children were learning how to dial and tune channels of reality, and that's the way the brain works. And it was no accident that your first great neurogenetic generation occurred when these post-Hiroshima mutants finally reached the age where they could proceed with neurological experimentation. Okay, the post-Hiroshima mutant generation hit college age, and it was a baby boom generation, you recall, during the 60s. Now, I'm going to review for a few minutes the 1960s. I think it's the most important decade in human history. I don't think... Hey, there we go. I see we have some veterans of the great uncivil war of the 60s assembled here. Hey, well... Okay, my fellow veterans of the 60s, I think the truth should come out. We won the war of the 60s, and it was a noble triumph. There's not one aspect of American culture that wasn't reviewed, reformed, changed, improved during the 1960s. Sure, we can celebrate about it. It was the greatest mutation in world history. It was done bloodlessly. It was done with good humor. And our main weapon was the notion of feel good. All right. We can sit around and congratulate ourselves, but I appeal to you, my fellow veterans of the 60s, we do not want to become like the veterans of other wars, like the American Legion or the VFW. Surely we must not let them encourage us to have annual conventions in cities like Philadelphia. Where you can run around barefoot with funny costumes and, you know, get busted for old time's sake. And surely we do not want them to build statues of barefoot, long-haired hippies in every court square. Peace, love, right on, unreal. No, we won a signal victory, my friends, but we must not relax in our laurels. Change is the name of the game, and I urge and invite my colleagues from the 60s to move into the 70s and 80s, because the wave of the 80s is going to make the 60s look like a ripple. Now, for those of you that weren't around during the 60s, let me review very briefly what happened in the 60s. You know, there's been a lot of rumor about the 60s, try to shove it under the rug. There have been two great literary conversations in American last 20, 30 years. One where Fitzgerald said to Hemingway, "The rich are different from us," and Hemingway said, "Yeah, they got more money." That proved Fitzgerald was smarter than Hemingway. Then there was a conversation in the 1970s between, of all people, Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote. And Tennessee Williams said, "Well, what happened in the 60s? I was drunk and in the mental hospital all the time." And Truman Capote said, "Nothing happened in the 60s. Ha ha." Well, I submit that is not quite true. A lot happened in the 60s. And I think American society and world society is much better because of what the first post-Hiroshima generation did in the 1960s. Number one, I cite you the parent-child relationship, the relationship between the generations. It's much more honest today. It's much more healthy today than it was in before the 60s. You may not remember back to the dark days of the Nixon administration when our government then, aping and modeling itself after the governments of Eastern Europe and Soviet Union, our American government sent home pamphlets to parents teaching them how to spy on and bust their kids. You know those pamphlets that, "If she comes home from school smiling, watch her." Well, in the last presidential election, we had the amazing and delightful phenomenon of Mrs. Betty Ford saying, "Sure, the kids smoke grass in the White House, but that's not what's important. What's important is we're honest about it. We don't have this hypocrisy." And Rosalind Carter said, "Yeah, sure, Chip got busted in front of the Navy for smoking grass, but that's not important. What's important is we can talk about it, and we don't have that horrid hypocrisy of one generation getting loaded and smashed on martinis in the front room while the other generation floats out the rear room windows." Another great change that happened in the 60s was the educational process itself. You have no idea how feudal, Prussian, and medieval universities were in the 1950s. In the 1950s, professors and administrators and deans were considered to be in loco parentis. That means they're supposed to be in the place of parents, which means they're supposed to keep boys and girls apart, right? And in the 1950s, if you can remember back to the days of Eisenhower, McCarthy, Elvis Presley, and Neil Sedaka, every college, they had a women's dormitory. It was like a maximum security prison with a matron to check the young ladies in and out to make sure that the inevitable did not happen. Well, the many sexual revolutions, liberation of the 60s, have changed American culture and world culture forever. We can never go back to the machoism that we had before the 60s. In the old days, there was the sex with either yes or no, but now there are many, many options for the expression of your love and beauty. And by the way, that's the key to everything I'm saying tonight. That's the signal, options. It's my hope and my desire that everyone that leaves this room tonight will go out that door with more options, more possibilities, more decisions and choices for different ways of living than you had when you walked in. And certainly that was one of the legacies of the 60s. Now, they say that there was a counterculture. There was no counterculture. This is a left-wing partisan statement. There were 100 countercultures. There were as many countercultures as there were groups of friends and lovers meeting together to look in each other's eyes and smile. That's the point of the 60s. There was not one orthodoxy being replaced by another orthodoxy. But the notion of do your own thing, that your brain creates your own reality, you make your own world, don't blame your parents, don't blame society, figure it out for yourself, because exactly how you feel and think and everything that you define as your reality comes from decisions that you make with that instrument that lies behind your forehead. Now, another thing that happened, I could go on, and listening to my fellow veterans citing the great victories of the 60s, I want to remind every young man in this room that you're living and you're sitting here tonight with a certain sense of freedom and serenity which you had because a generation before yours cared enough and put their bodies on the line enough to end the peacetime draft. The bottom line on the 60s, of course, is that it's a consciousness, it was a consciousness movement, a consciousness revolution. Now, in the second part of this program, I'm going to be talking to you about some ideas that may be new to some of you, space migration, for example. And you may say, wow, he's freaked out again. Yeah. But I want to remind you that in 1960, 61, 1962, I'd come before audiences like this and I'd say, hey, my friends, I got news for you. Do you know that consciousness can be changed? And people would look at me with blank expressions and say, what do you mean? You're either awake or you're asleep. I said, no, it's a little more complicated than that. The very notion of consciousness didn't exist in the late 50s, except certain occult groups and English philosophers and Oriental translated philosophers. But as a mass concept, consciousness did not exist. Now, of course, we realize that consciousness and pleasure have become our number one national industry. The Great American Consumer Society, of course, has co-opted consciousness and pleasure. That's all right. There's no complaint about that. Consciousness and pleasure as a national industry is probably better than Detroit automobiles, which is our last national religion. This business of consciousness has two parts. One is the discovery of the body, body consciousness. Now, before the 60s, the human body was considered to be a robot that you fed three times a day. It was trained to perform certain robot productive tasks, and that was about it. Oh, you could bounce up and down each other on Saturday night for reproductive purposes only. But the very concept of body awareness did not exist. Now we have seen this incredible industry of body awareness, water beds and satin sheets and hair blowers for macho athletes, not to mention the scents and perfumes and the new forms of dress, the new forms of aesthetics, not to mention the health foods and diets, not to mention the martial arts and karate. I could stand here and for an hour and list you the many money-making aspects of body consciousness and pleasure that have developed in the last 10 years, which did not exist as concepts before the great revolution of the 60s. I want to remind you, see, that the very notion of pleasure as an end point or a goal or a good thing in life was really unheard of, except a few Hollywood stars or a few jet-set princes. But, you know, that the average middle-class citizen could be involved in pleasure? I mean, before the 60s, the theology was this on pleasure. For every little pleasure, there's a pain, pain, pain. And so God was this accountant who kept your pleasure scoreboard. And woe be to you if you overdrew your pleasure account, because the wages of pleasure are something terrible. Well, we learned in the 60s, with some help from our Oriental friends, we learned that the human body has an enormous repertoire spectrum of portholes and sense organs and antenna and radar pickups, and that there are not just one way, but there are dozens or hundreds of ways of turning on your body to new awareness and to new pleasure and to new health. We also learned something very interesting about pleasure in the 60s. It's so easy to suffer. You know, just listen to the TV or radio or do what they tell you in the newspapers, and you just relax and you'll suffer. I mean, they'll give you 100 bad trips a day. You know? The easy, lazy thing to do is just go on suffering in a repetitious way. It's really more energetic, and it's more challenging, it's more intelligent to devote yourself to the development of pleasure. You know, pleasure is not some lazy, indolent thing. Pleasure is a science. Pleasure is an art. We learned in the 60s that pleasure is something you could improve. You could keep your hedonic index and watch yourself improve from week to week. We also learned in the 60s, and this is quite important, that learning to feel good, learning to feel good is like any other complicated art. It's like tennis. Always play with someone equal or better than you. And by all odds, avoid people in situations that bring you down and professional sufferers and people whose aim is political or religious to make you feel bad. Avoid them as you would avoid the plague. I think the greatest breakthrough of the 60s was this. We discovered the brain as an organ, as a tool, as an instrument. We are told that in Freudian Vienna and Victorian England, the genitals 100 years ago were the unmentionables. Well, certainly now the genitals are not the unmentionables. Look at any newsstand and they are the unavoidables. But up until very recently, up until the mid-60s, the taboo organ, the unmentionable organ, was the human brain. And neurology had not progressed one step for 50 years. Why? Because the facts about the human brain, the facts that the human brain determines our reality, the facts that the human brain can be changed, the facts that we can learn how to use this tool and thus create our realities and create surreal realities and create better realities, this concept simply did not exist, the idea that you could change your head. I happened to be trained as a psychologist in the 1950s, and I want to tell you, there was no concept of change in the 50s. Oh, yeah, for $20, $30 an hour, you could go to a Freudian psychoanalyst for 5 years, and you could get some insight into why you couldn't change. But the notion that you could actually change was pre-revolutionary. I want to tell you that it was the 1950s that made the 1960s possible. In the 1950s, there was a movement in psychology. There was a really strong, powerful revolution. It was a quiet revolution because it was fought in the clinic rooms and the research laboratories and the mental hospitals and in the college academic seminar rooms, but it was fought bitterly. And this fight involved those of us who realized that we had to wrest the responsibility and authority of behavior change away from the witch doctors and the Freudian psychoanalysts and give it back to the people who are involved in it. The do-it-yourself movement in psychology predated the movement of the 60s, and you wouldn't have had the 60s if you didn't have the work of Harry Stack Sullivan, Carl Rogers, Abe Maslow, the Esalen Institute. And I honor and acknowledge these great pioneers because I want to tell you, it was really controversial. You literally put your reputation, your career on the line if you bucked the psychiatric medical establishment in those days. You know, they even had laws passed that you couldn't try to counsel or help anyone else unless you had an MD and a psychoanalytic diploma. And this notion of do-it-yourself, which led to the encounter groups, it led to group therapy, it led to mental health movement, it led to a lot of kooky extremes, but that's all right. Anytime you free people's consciousness, you're going to get them scattered off in many directions. But this is the kind of anarchy and variation and differentiation that the DNA code, the biological intelligence, loves. Because from such variation comes the next mutation. And you would not have had the drug culture movement of the 60s if you did not have the do-it-yourself psychology movement of the 50s. Because drugs have been around for centuries. Baudelaire, man, every Victorian poet was on opium. Every French poet was on hashish. Mescaline was around in Europe. There are many German scientists. Certainly Michael Horowitz here has got a library of research that was done for centuries on drugs. So drugs, they knew about drugs. Matter of fact, we went to Harvard in the early 60s. There were several thousand papers been written on the use of LSD. But nobody listened to those papers or read them because the doctors, they were doing these research, didn't get the point. That the point is that the brain is an instrument that can be changed, but only you are aware of what's happening in your brain. Therefore, it's got to be the individual himself or herself, trained, prepared, disciplined for the responsibility to take charge of your own head. The final thing I want to say about the 60s is this. You know why we went through all that consciousness movement and this consciousness change in the 60s? Well, you have your reasons, I have mine. I'll give you my reasons. We did it so we could become better lovers. The higher you get, the more you see. The more territory you see. That's obvious. On the other hand, the higher you get, the faster you can move with greater precision. And to me, the definition of intelligence is moving faster, flying higher, with greater precision, so that you can hook up in better fusions and linkages. Because the more conscious you become, the more exquisitely aesthetic and deeply philosophic and rewarding your relationships with those who share your altitude and your acceleration and velocity. Now, I've just given you the love commercial, so I will proceed to my final comments of this part of the program. Has the DNA code worked or played for 2.5 billion years to produce you, the first and second post-Hiroshima generation, highly conscious, self-activated, suntanned, yogically graceful, polyphase orgasm sensory consumers? That's great. I'm happy about that. I certainly don't want to move into the future with anyone who doesn't have control and confidence in their own body. And I don't want to move into the future with anyone who doesn't have control and conscious direction of their own head.
You're listening to The Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
And that lovely voice you just heard is that of none other than the one and only Black Beauty, the host of BB's Bungalow on the Cannabis Podcast Network, which you can find at dopefiend.co.uk. I was remiss last week in that I forgot to congratulate Bibi on having completed her first year of podcasting from the bungalow. And in addition to her own program, Bibi also appears from time to time on several of the other great podcasts coming from the Dope Fiends Network. So if you haven't already heard one of her programs, you might want to give her a listen. I think you'll really enjoy the show. And as for today's show here in the salon, I found it interesting early on in this talk when he was talking about how the dope-smoking, acid-taking hippies were taking over and becoming the establishment. Well, it didn't really turn out as rosy as he was hoping, did it? But then again, those geeky acid heads did their part and invented the personal computer and the internet. But the ones who went into politics didn't hold up their end of the bargain. You know, maybe if Bill Clinton had actually inhaled while he was in college, he might have gotten laid a bit more and wouldn't have had to chase young women around the Oval Office just to get a blowjob. So let that be a lesson to you aspiring politicians out there, particularly the male ones. Always be sure to inhale, and a lot. It can only make you better. Of course, we've talked about that here in the salon before, the fact that without even realizing it was taking place, my generation became the establishment, and now we're being replaced by the baby boomers, who are just as screwed up as my generation is. That's why I think that nobody over 30 should be allowed to be the president. After that age, most people seem to have been forced into so many economic and family situations where major compromises are called for, that all of those early dreams and visions of youth are left behind in the great race to buy stuff. Of course, if we had only politicians who were under 30, things might get even more screwed up. But quite frankly, I don't even see how that's possible. You know, it's time for a change, my friends, a very radical change. But I wouldn't get my hopes up for that taking place in the immediate future because, in my humble opinion, even Obama is far too much of an establishment candidate, and he appears to be far too fearful of losing his newfound power to be able to bring about many changes from the current status quo. You know, I once thought the Clintons would foster the type of changes our culture needs if it's going to continue on for another 100 years. But they sold us out and left a legacy of more nonviolent drug possessors being put in prison cages than ever before. And at the same time, Clinton was imprisoning our friends, relatives, and neighbors for having a few grams of plant matter in their possession. He was having sex with young student interns in his office. What a pitiful excuse for an inspiring leader he was. Thankfully, he won't be returning to the White House anytime soon. I'll get off this now, but my point is that there is no one but yourself that you should count on to make a change in your life. No politician, even a well-meaning one, is going to be able to deliver anything even resembling honesty and justice when it comes to the war against people who use mind-altering substances. Heck, the number two guy on the Democratic ticket is the jerk responsible for a mandatory minimum sentencing and is also the guy who came up with the concept of a drug czar. Yet he even appears to be halfway sane when compared to the nut job of a vice president the Republicans are trying to push down our throats. So spend your time and money supporting your favorite candidates if you want to, but it seems to me that you can do more good by helping to get the true story out about the psychedelic community, getting it out to the rest of the world. So don't be afraid to stand up and be counted. You know, if we don't continue to speak out right now, we may be silenced for a long time, just as Dr. Timothy Leary was for many years. I realize that some of what Timothy Leary spoke about just now may seem like ancient history to you, but if we don't remember what transpired in our relatively recent past, we aren't going to be able to navigate the twists and turns that are about to come our way. At least that's what I think. You know, I lived through some of the things Leary mentioned, like the medieval college system this country once had. And I hope you'll believe me when I say that things really sucked back in the good old days. For me, the good old days began as an undergraduate in the fall of 1960, and I graduated in June of 64. Now, the school I attended was a men-only Catholic college, and I'm here to tell you that, at least back then, it was a place that tried to tell you what to think instead of teaching you how to think. Now, I realize that both Notre Dame and other U.S. universities have made some improvements since then. For example, I understand my old alma mater now has women undergraduate, and that the priests no longer turn off all the electricity to the dorms after the 10:30 bed check, as they did when I went there. So I'm hoping you're beginning to get the picture that back just a few decades ago, things were unbelievably buttoned down in this country. And the reason I think it's so important for you to hear these stories is because if we don't pay attention to them, we're going to be blindsided once again and have to start all over in building what is rapidly becoming a very robust and worldwide psychedelic community. And speaking of the psychedelic community, here in our own little corner of that world, the beat goes on. In fact, there's getting to be so much going on over at all of the forums on thegrowreport.com that I hardly have time to surf through all of the posts, let alone add any comments of my own. There's truly an amazing amount of information, and most of it new to me, that you can find over there. Here's one item I want to pass on to our fellow saloners who may live within driving distance of Arkansas, because it has to do with a question I'm asked a lot. Namely, if I can't go to Peru or to Burning Man, how am I ever going to find the others? Well, there are now quite a few of these kinds of events, including one I hadn't heard of until just now. This was posted on the forum by Kabu Kissensee. I hope I pronounced that right. It's a very cool handle, though, even if I may have mangled the pronunciation. Anyway, he or she posted a notice that on October 3rd, 4th, and 5th of this year, And it's now 2008, in case you've been out of touch for a while. Anyway, on those dates, if you travel to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, you'll find the Coalescence Festival. And according to their website, and I'll post a link to it with the show notes for this program, but there's going to be some great music and top-notch DJs there, as well as talks by some of our old friends from here in the salon. Right now, the scheduled speakers include Alex Gray, John Major Jenkins, Daniel Pinchbeck, Dennis McKenna, and quite a few others. So if you're looking for a musical, camping, and intellectual experience without all of the wind and dust from Burning Man, this may just be the festival for you. Now, another question I've been receiving lately has to do with psychedelics in the family. I'll read you part of a message I received about this from Felix, who says, "As I was listening to the latest podcast, which is the one with Nick and Myron on it, somehow I got to thinking about career and that sort of thing, and how I am getting to the point in my life where I have to decide what part psychedelics will play in my life. One thing besides Big Brother I thought of was family. So my question is, what do you think about family and psychedelics? You've mentioned your children briefly and had talks by the Grays on the topic, but it does not do much good for me. My dad, for example, is likely 5 years or so younger than you are, but I am quite hesitant to tell him or my mother about the part these sacred medicines play in my life and thoughts. My paths, academic, musical, and spiritual, have all been touched by them. But to my parents, it is merely worrisome that I read the books I do and occasionally quote Tim Leary, and of course ingest the chemicals I do. What's a guy to do? I'm not a teenager anymore, so I don't have to negotiate with them as authority figures anymore, but merely as people I love and don't want to alienate, which is almost trickier. I haven't even tried to deal with extended family, aunts, uncles, grandparents, cousins. Anyway, it is something to think on, and I thought you might like to think on it too." Well, Felix, I have in fact given this a lot of thought, but so far I haven't been able to come up with any good ideas about the topic at all. As I've mentioned before, when my children and were young and beginning to experiment with these substances, I did everything wrong. In fact, I was as uninformed about our sacred medicines as a person could be. Today, I, of course, would handle things very differently than I did 25 years ago. But the problem you point out is one that almost every young person in this country is facing, namely, how do you teach your parents? How do you get them to listen to you when it comes to talking about these topics? The irony, of course, is that there are very few parents who are as well informed about this subject as are their children. You know, at least the children who are smart enough to get their drug education from places like Arrowwood.org and not from that crapola that the schools and churches are attempting to force into our brains. I wish there was some kind of a one-size-fits-all answer to that question, but so far I haven't come across anything like that myself. Maybe one approach might be to get a copy of Jack Harrer's great book, The Emperor Has No Clothes, and start asking your parents some questions about the facts that he sets out in that wonderful little book. It should be mandatory reading, in fact, for all psychonauts, and a discussion of it with your parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles might just break a logjam of silence in your family and get this subject back out in the open where we can talk about it like civilized people. But if any of our fellow saloners have some ideas on that, well, you might want to add it as a topic on our forum. One other thing Felix had to say was, "On a lighter note, are there any stats on which podcasts are the most popular? Is there a greatest hits of the salon?" Well, Felix, no, I'm afraid that I don't keep any stats like that. In fact, I delete our logs every month simply because I don't think that information has any value for a website that doesn't advertise. But from occasionally looking at what is being downloaded during a typical day, I'm always surprised to see that Terrence McKenna and Tim Leary are very seldom at the top of the list. So maybe I'm still overloading you with these guys. I'll have to dig around and come up with a little more variety, I guess. Another message I received that is also somewhat typical comes from Matt, who joins us here in the salon each week from his home in New Zealand. Here's what he has to say. I just wanted to reach you to let you know you have a new avid listener in New Zealand. I would certainly donate if I wasn't on the verge of going broke. Such is life. I only discovered this subject in depth and indeed the wider community at large through Terence McKenna somewhere online maybe 6 months ago and have been captivated ever since. Gradually, this has led me to find further people of interest online and is what led me to your podcasts most recently. Keep up the great work. I'm telling others here in New Zealand about your podcasts. Well, for what it's worth, Matt, telling others about these podcasts is every bit as important to me as are the financial donations. I obviously couldn't keep expanding the bandwidth and other physical requirements for delivering tens of thousands of copies of these podcasts each week without the financial help of our community, but equally important is finding the others, as Terence always preached. So helping others find these podcasts is one way that you can help, even when your funds have dried up. We've all been there before, and most of us are there right now. So don't worry about making a financial contribution to the Salon. Just by listening each week, you're contributing more than you can know to the psychedelic community. We're all in this together, you know, and so it's always good to be together here with you and our other fellow Saloners here in cyberdelic space. So as the Bard McKenna said, keep the old faith and stay high. Now, as always, I'll once again close this podcast by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are available for your use under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And, of course, that's where you're also going to find the program notes for these podcasts. So for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.